from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Over there's old Biscuit. He, him. Found something good to read there, Biscuit.
Oh, yes, indeed. Just reading from the good book, Becoming by Michelle Obama.
Ain't that a good book? Tell you, ain't nothing finer than reading on your solar heated porch, sipping lemonade through a reusable metal straw.
Before we eat, I should wash my hands. You know where the men's room is?
Yeah, it's back in 2015. We don't have a men's room, but the alt-gender restrooms is just down the way.
Oh, you guys have a alt-gender restroom?
Uh-oh, Sheriff. I think your cousin thinks we're all crazy Christian types.
Oh, no. I never said that. And even if you are, it's fine. I mean, I'm Jewish.
Hold on. You're Jewish?
Yeah.
Well, I hope you know what we do to Jewish folks down here in Georgia. We elect them!
Saturday Night Live's take on the traditionally red state of Georgia flipping blue in the 2020 election. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Monday, February 1st. Joe's under the weather today. With us, we have White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network. Reverend Al Sharpton joins us. NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent and the host of Way Too Early, Casey Hunt, stays with us. And senior columnist for the Daily Beast, Matt Lewis, joins us this morning. Thank you all for jumping on board this morning. We have even more to get to than usual on this Monday morning, if that's possible. A group of Republican senators head to the White House today to pitch President Biden on their much smaller counteroffer to his COVID relief proposal. We're learning more about Democrats' strategy for the Trump impeachment trial as the former president scrambles to put together a legal team. It's a funny thing that happens when you're not president anymore. If people think you're wrong, they leave. QAnon Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene will meet this week with Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy as things heat up between her and a colleague on the Hill. The South African coronavirus strain is discovered in another U.S. state. A massive winter storm moves east, expected to affect more than 100 million Americans with a brutal mix of snow, rain, and high winds. We'll get to Bill Cairns in a moment on that. A lot to cover this morning. We'll begin, though, with that group of 10 Republican senators who will meet with President Biden at the White House today to discuss their counteroffer to his nearly $2 trillion economic relief proposal. The group of mostly moderate senators outlined their proposal in a letter to the president yesterday, requesting a meeting. The Republican outreach is an attempt to prevent Democrats from using the process of reconciliation to push through Biden's proposal without any Republican support. The $600 billion counteroffer is less than a third of what the president is proposing. It includes $160 billion for vaccines, $4 billion for health and substance abuse services, the continuation of current unemployment and unspecified targeted economic assistance and help for schools. It does not mention Democrats' priorities like state and local aid. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has already pushed back, telling the New York Daily News, quote, they should negotiate with us, not a make it or take it or leave it offer. Now, Casey, what's happening here? Because obviously there's a lot that needs to be rectified in terms of response to COVID. And President Biden seems to be covering that, you know, from soup to nuts on trying to get the train back on the tracks or on the tracks in the first place. But are they trying to put in too much of sort of Biden's agenda in this bill?
That's the question here, Mika. And of course, Biden, big picture, comes into office and has to grapple with more crises than perhaps any other president in the last century. And they tried, I think, their goal by putting out a bill this big was to try and address as many of those problems up front as possible. But it's left Republicans looking at it and saying, is a $15 minimum wage really part of an emergency relief package? It's more like a policy Democrats have been pushing for many years. And they're saying, look, if you actually want to do this bipartisanship that you have pitched during your campaign, we need to have a different kind of conversation. So I think that's going to be the question today. And just how Biden's doing this, having them down to the White House, is different than what we saw with President Trump. The question is, how is Biden going to interact with them? And then how does he balance the demands of the progressives in his caucus in the Senate who are saying, you know what? No, we waited around for Republicans to do deals with us under the Obama administration. They didn't do it. We need to move ahead. Honestly, Republicans used these procedures a couple of times under the Trump administration, and they didn't blink twice about doing it without Democratic votes. So that's what he's going to have to balance today.
Jonathan Lemire, what's the view from the White House? Because this is supposed to be a big page turner from the Trump White House to the Biden White House. And one of the things that Joe Biden campaigned on and promised in, you know, on the day that he was elected is that he would be a president for all people, even people who didn't vote for him, and that he would try and bring bipartisanship back to the White House where both sides debated issues. And they went through the process. So the view from the White House on this massive bill is what?
Well, Mika, you're certainly right about that. And my colleagues and I looked at it this weekend that Biden really framed himself as a candidate, as someone who could bring the parties together, who could sort of take down the temperature of an overheated Washington under Donald Trump. And he certainly, as a senator, and as particularly as vice president, would work with Republicans. He was Barack Obama's liaison to the Hill, and it was his dealings with leader McConnell that really got a lot of things, fiscal cliff and debt negotiations done for that White House. And he has been indeed working the phones to senators of both parties, it should be noted, in recent days. And certainly there's also a need to keep some moderate Democrats in line, Manchin, Sinema from West Virginia and Arizona in particular. Look, they absolutely, this is a White House that is trying to prioritize bipartisanship. They would love to have some Republicans on here. But at the same time, they've been sending signals that they're willing to go it alone, to do this legislative procedure known as reconciliation, which could just be done with Democrats. So certainly, President Biden, he's eager to have the meeting. They're having these senators over there today. And even getting $700, $800 billion, whatever that number may be, in a bipartisan deal, that would still be a win for Biden, even if it falls well short of what they want now. And I think that is going to be a difficult sell to some of the Democrats. And I think that we're going to need to see some sort of negotiation here, that they're going to need to have each side we're certainly going to have to give some in order to get this deal done with a bipartisan print. Also interesting to watch, to this point, the White House has been reluctant to split this bill in two, to just focus on virus and vaccines in one, and then other priorities in a second piece. The calculation here, we'll have to see if that changes, but certainly this is a big week if this is going to come together in a bipartisan fashion. If not, I think you'll see Democrats try to push more alone, particularly as next week the impeachment trial of Donald Trump begins, which is going to take up the heat even further.
So we've got a lot to get to this morning, but Reverend Al, you did speak to Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. What's his mindset on this? Any room for negotiation?
First, I think Senator Schumer, who was on Politics Nation with us on Saturday night before this meeting was agreed upon, but made it clear that they were going to fight all the way around this $1.9 trillion package the White House had presented. I think he's said subsequently very clearly that the Republicans in the Senate ought to be negotiating with the Democrats in the Senate and not just going to the White House trying to give it a take it or leave it kind of package to the president. Whether the president will come down from $1.9 trillion to $700, $800 billion is a huge gap that he will have to try and deal with with not only the progressive wing of the Democrats, but people that are looking for more assistance during COVID 19, which is what is in his package, those that are needing more vaccination and distribution of COVID 19 testing. So there's a lot on the table here, and the American people expect him to deliver. And I think he's right to meet with them, but meeting and caving is two different things.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk to some economists on the wisdom of this bill and continue the conversation. But we've got a lot to get to. 77 days. The New York Times front page today looks at the time spent by President Trump in his unprecedented campaign to subvert the results of the presidential election, all leading up to the Capitol riots on January 6th, when a pro-Trump mob tried to violently stop Congress's constitutional duty of certifying the victory of President Joe Biden. The Times' day-by-day examination of the events leading up to the moment paints a picture of just how, quote, a lie that Mr. Trump had been grooming for years finally overwhelmed the Republican Party. And as break after break fell away, was propelled forward by new and more radical lawyers, political organizers, financiers, and the surround sound right-wing media. As the paper puts it, across those 77 days, the forces of disorder were summoned and directed by the departing president, who wielded the power derived from his near infallible status among the party faithful in one final norm-defying act of a reality-denying presidency. Meanwhile, former President Trump yesterday announced a new legal team that will represent him at his second impeachment trial set to begin next week. He's changing legal teams now, a week before. NBC News reports lawyers David Schoen and Bruce Castor are coming on board. That comes just days after South Carolina attorneys Butch Bowers and Deborah Barbier and their team came to a, quote, mutual decision to part ways with Trump a week before the trial. The former president reportedly wanted them to falsely argue that he won the election and it was stolen through voter fraud. Trump's spokesman, Jason Miller, calls that reporting fake news. Sources speaking anonymously told the Washington Post the South Carolina team was uncomfortable making the unsubstantiated claims and instead wanted to argue the unconstitutionality of impeaching a president who has already left office. Meanwhile, New York Times reporter Michael Grimbaum tweeted that Trump's new legal team consists of a lawyer who met with Jeffrey Epstein in prison and told Fox he didn't believe Epstein killed himself. The other declined to prosecute Bill Cosby in 2005 for sexual assault, citing insufficient evidence. So, Matt Lewis, first of all, just the optics of the president's legal team leaving him a week before the trial begins shows me what a difference the presidency makes. When you're president, you have certain authority and power and people want access to you and they will bend even against their core values sometimes to stay close to power. When you're not president, you look at someone who's speaking stuff that makes no sense or that isn't true or that could get them in legal trouble, you walk away. Your thoughts?
I think there's a lot of benefits to incumbency to being the president. You just mentioned one of them. Executive privilege may end up being another one. I think the problem, though, for those of us who think that Donald Trump should be impeached and convicted is that it's not about the lawyers. It's about the jury. I think that, I don't expect that there's going to be a great defense of Donald Trump, even if you had the best attorneys in the world, which Donald Trump no longer has. I just don't think that there's a compelling defense of Donald Trump that you could actually make. The problem, of course, is the jury pool, and some of which are co-conspirators, I would actually say. So this is not good for Donald Trump, but I still think that he's probably in pretty good shape in terms of acquittal.
All right, Jonathan Lemire, your take on this. I mean, you've been following Trump. I think you get a sense of what could be happening behind closed doors. I mean, there's a lot of people who know that he is obsessed with saying that he won the election. And I just don't think that tune will change even as he is facing another impeachment trial. Your thoughts?
No question, Mika. He has suggested that he wants to use this trial to again make that assertion that he did win this election. Now, we haven't heard from him, obviously, in a couple of weeks. The lack of his Twitter account is, of course, important, and it has sort of removed him. It silenced him from the public stage. But privately, he is still talking about the election, that it was stolen from him. He has listened to aides' advice, that he hasn't, like, gone on, done interviews or anything that he could say or do that might upset more Republican senators. They feel confident right now he's being acquitted. They don't want him to rock the boat. At least for now, he's willing to do that. But of course, that could change because he's Donald Trump, and things change with him on an impulse or a whim at any time. But they do feel confident, despite this legal change right here, despite the perception that there's really no real legal strategy, that they're going to be acquitted. So, Reverend Sharpton, let me go to you. We seem to know what the outcome of this trial is before it begins. But Democrats, of course, are going to forge forward here. We know how important this is to them. You spoke to Majority Leader Schumer. What did he say in terms of their legal strategy? What are they trying to push? And did you get any sense from him that they'd be willing to settle for a censure?
I was struck by the fact that the majority leader, Senator Schumer, said to us that that the trial was going to be full with videos, with dramatic evidence of what the president did in terms of the inciting of the attempted coup d'etat and insurrection. And he seemed to be clearly saying they're going full steam ahead with the trial. I asked him about whether they would go for censor. He says, we're going forward with the trial. If he's not convicted, we'll deal with other things later, but we're focused on the trial. Censorship was not part of it. I think this discussion of whether or not the president, former president, is going to try to say he was robbed of the election or somehow the election was stolen doesn't address what he is being impeached for. He's impeached for inciting an insurrection. It has nothing to do with the election. And I think people need to really deal with what he is facing there. He needs to answer his conduct leading to the takeover, siege, and threatening of life and taking of five lives on the Capitol. It has nothing to do with his illusions of what happened on November 3rd.
And then that brings us to this. Democratic Congresswoman Cori Bush of Missouri announced on Friday that she is moving her congressional office away from Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene after a heated exchange where Bush confronted the Georgia Republican about not wearing a mask in a hallway on Capitol Hill. Bush tweeted, "A maskless Marjorie Taylor Greene and her staff berated me in a hallway. She targeted me on others on social media. I am moving my office away from hers for my team's safety." Greene responded on Twitter, posting a portion of a video she claims is of the incident, and said that, in fact, the Democratic Congresswoman berated her.
Then they supported bail bond links for criminals. You know what? Yeah, don't yell at people. You know what? You shouldn't bring COVID positive members in here, spreading COVID everywhere. Stop being a hypocrite. Yeah, this is how it is here now. This is how it is. Stop being a hypocrite.
The incident led Speaker Nancy Pelosi to approve Bush's request to move her office as tensions between the two parties have grown in the aftermath of the Capitol riot. Meanwhile, a senior Republican aide tells NBC News that House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy is expected to meet with Congresswoman Greene this week. It is unclear exactly when the meeting will be taking place. And Senator Mitt Romney weighed in on the news that Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene had spoken by phone with former President Trump. He tweeted, "Lies of a feather flock together, Marjorie Taylor Greene's nonsense, and the big lie of a stolen election." His tweet came in response to Greene praising her phone conversation with Trump in a series of tweets. She wrote in part, quote, "I had a great call with my all-time favorite POTUS, President Trump. I'm so grateful for his support, and more importantly, the people of this country are absolutely 100% loyal to him because he is 100% loyal to the people and America first." You know, Casey, there's so much more that this woman has brought to the table than even what I just reported, including pictures of herself pointing a gun toward members of Congress, screaming at Parkland victims, running after them. I mean, this Congresswoman is not something the Republicans want as to represent them if they want bipartisanship. I mean, this is another major problem. I'm curious if you have any intel or gut feelings on this meeting with Kevin McCarthy, because Kevin McCarthy, in my opinion, doesn't get it either.
So, Mika, you're right to point out that the things that Marjorie Taylor Greene has said online, many of them are really astonishing, especially I would put at the top of the list the idea that the school shootings, all those children who died at Sandy Hook, that was actually a false flag event. Parkland, similarly, the high school in Florida, and then to have her placed on the education committee. I know that I have seen some Sandy Hook parents tweeting and talking about the grief that this has caused them. She is also out there questioning September 11th and the attacks and indulging in conspiracy theories around that. And the reality is, they knew this going in. Republican leaders did. This is not, most of this stuff's old. It's been out there. Some of it was written about before the election. And I remember talking to Republican sources before she was elected and saying to them, what are you doing about this? Don't you think this is going to be a big problem if this person wins your primary? Because if they win the primary, they're almost guaranteed to become a member of Congress. And the decision at the time was they didn't want to poke the bear, really. They didn't want to take a risk that potentially they would be in trouble with then President Trump if they went after her. They also, I think more reasonable minds thought, well, we may draw attention to her in a way that would make it more likely that she would win if we endorsed and fought for her primary opponent. And so that was a calculation. We're just going to let this happen, even though we know it's ongoing. And so heading into the meeting this week, I think it's the same set of questions. You know, they didn't do anything about her before. Why is anything going to change here if they had all of this information going into it? So, you know, I think Kevin McCarthy is clearly trying to please everybody right now. And if President Trump is on board with Marjorie Taylor Greene, I struggle to see how Kevin McCarthy is going to say no.
President Trump is not in charge anymore, but I'm missing something here. Matt, I want to get your take on this. You might explain it to me. Marjorie Taylor Greene and this sort of problem they have with her, or I would see it as a problem, in light of your latest piece entitled The GOP Will Be Staying with Trump Right to the Graveyard. Help me understand. You write in part this: Donald Trump is now the definition of a loser, a one-term president who lost both the House and the Senate. But instead of being chastened by him, Republicans are chasing him. Not only is the GOP going mad, they are also clinging to a failed political leader and a losing electoral strategy. And if you think my calling them insane is too harsh, remember that one definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Matt, what's going on? How do you help these people?
Help me help you. That's what I say to them.
Yes.
It's a vicious cycle. There are perverse incentives. This has been going on for a long time. But now there's a different sort of insurrection, right? The call is coming from inside the building. These aren't just activists or voters who believe in conspiracy theories. Now we have members of Congress who were elected who believe in crazy conspiracy theories. So it's just gotten progressively worse over time. And look, I think Casey has a point. I think Republicans they saw this coming. They didn't know how to deal with it. And I think at first there's an argument, you know, ignore it, it'll go away, or we can wait out Trump. Trump's going to fizzle eventually, and then I'll inherit his voters. And we don't want to turn Trump or Marjorie Taylor Greene into a martyr. That didn't work. The idea of ignoring this problem and hoping it will go away did not work. And so I think now Republicans are at a point, and maybe probably is too late to do this, but any adults who are left have to throw out that strategy. It really has to be, this is a war, a battle for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. Is this going to be the party of Lincoln and Reagan a thoughtful, decent political party. Look, I think there ought to be a political party that believes in things like defending the right to life and limited government and a strong national defense. Right now, there's not a party. The Democrats elected, I think, the most centrist candidate possible as president, but he's going to end up representing a lot of, you know, views that I probably don't agree with. There ought to be a decent center right political party in America, and there needs to be adults who fight for it. And I think that's one of the big stories. Donald Trump understood that the elites in the Republican Party were basically inept and they were weak. And I think that is one of the big stories here. Nobody stopped this. Mitch McConnell, to his credit, did some of that in the U.S. Senate. It obviously hasn't happened in the House.
Matt Lewis, thank you very, very much. We've got a lot to get to this morning, especially pertaining to the coronavirus. Still ahead on Morning Joe, two big city mayors join us with the latest on their struggle to get enough vaccine. New York City's Bill de Blasio and Chicago's Lori Lightfoot, who is dealing with COVID and a battle with the teachers' union over getting teachers back in the classroom. It is complicated. But first, let's go to Bill Cairns with a check on the severe weather slamming the Northeast. Bill?
Hey, good morning to you, Mika. New York City is well underway to seeing their biggest snowstorm in 5 years. Many areas of the Northeast will be digging out from about at least a foot of snow this time tomorrow morning. So let's get to the numbers. 75 million people are under winter weather alerts, either advisories or warnings. Areas in red, that's who's going to get it the worst. Philadelphia northwards all through portions of New England. Here's a look at the radar. The blue is the snow. The areas of green is the rain. So south of Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore, it's been mostly rain overnight, but the snow from Long Island, New York City is now expanding all through southern New England. Many reports already of 2 to 4 inches on the ground. So additional snowfall everywhere you see on this map in pink is 18 inches. Purple is 12. The blue is at least an additional 3 to 6 inches. And here's the snowfall forecast for some of the big cities. You notice New York City could easily see the highest totals of any big city. Though some of those mountainous areas in the Poconos and Catskills, someone will get over 20 inches of snow when this is all said and done. High winds will also this afternoon. This is when the peak of the storm will be around New York City to Boston. It'll be from about 10 a.m. till about 6 p.m. So here's the timing for some of our big cities out there. It does look like Philadelphia especially is going to see some of the heaviest snow as we go throughout late this afternoon, whatever's left for you. It does look like the worst of the snow in Philadelphia will be over with by about, I'd say, 7 or 8 p.m. tonight, 4 to 8 inches total. New York City, this could be historic, near blizzard conditions this afternoon. Totals around 12 to 16 inches, peak gusts 30 to 40 miles per hour. So that'll be quite the sight to see later on this afternoon in New York City. Maybe even some lightning and thunder with some of those snow bands. That'd be pretty impressive. Here's a shot of Times Square. Reports in Central Park right now, 3 inches on the ground. We could get another foot at least. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
We're following two big stories overseas. Over 5,000 people were arrested across Russia at protests in support of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Navalny has called for protests since he was detained upon arriving in Moscow last month from Berlin, where he was being treated for poisoning. For the second weekend in a row, demonstrators took to the streets, clashing with police as authorities arrested several supporters of Navalny. His team has called for more protests tomorrow when Navalny is expected to face another court hearing. And breaking overnight, Myanmar's military seized power in a coup and reportedly detained the country's civilian government led by Aung San Suu Kyi, along with leaders of her party. The military made the announcement on its television channel yesterday, saying in part it took over the government over claims of fraud in last November's elections. The military also announced that it expects to hold another election in a year and would hand over power to the winner. Last week's stock market frenzy, fueled by inflated values of GameStop, AMC, and other companies, has left major concerns over the market's instability. The main hedge fund has shorted GameStop, Melvin Capital, and has now reportedly lost over 50% on investments in January. Meanwhile, Senator Elizabeth Warren is calling on the SEC to open an investigation into the matter and noted on Twitter, quote, casino-like swings in stock prices of GameStop reflect wild levels of speculation that don't help GameStop's workers or customers and could lead to market instability. We'll be following that. And some incredible new drone footage out of California shows the damage to a portion of California's Highway 1 near Big Sur after a debris slide caused heavy rains, washed the road into the ocean last week. The 150-foot gap was discovered by workers on Friday. No one was injured in the collapse. That stretch of highway had been closed since Tuesday due to heavy rains. Oy. Finally, the Major League Baseball Players Association is considering a proposal to delay the start of the new season because of the pandemic. The plan presented by the league on Friday would push back the start of spring training by about a month, slating opening day for April 28th instead of the 1st, and cut the regular season from 162 games to 154. ESPN now reports that if the union does not provide a counteroffer by early next week, spring training will likely start in mid-February as scheduled. Jonathan Lemire, I mean, they're trying to make this happen in a safe way. What would be the argument against a little bit of a delay?
Well, certainly, Mika, on a day when so much of the country is being pounded by a snowstorm, the thought of spring training is a really appealing one. But you're right. First of all, there's a lot of distrust here between the players' union and the MLB owners. It was certainly a very thorny negotiations a year ago during that COVID season. And you're right. The game itself, Major League Baseball, is suggesting we'll push things back. There'll be a wider distribution of the vaccine by then. Hopefully, numbers of cases will have come down. You know, by perhaps as the season goes on, this would allow more fans to actually enter the ballparks. They won't be full, but that some fans, thousands of fans perhaps spread out, could sit in some of these stadiums anyway to watch the games. And they're offering full pay, even if it's 154 games rather than 162. That's, of course, very important to the players. But the players feel like that they're not getting enough in exchange, because baseball also wants expanded playoffs, a universal DH, and things of that matter. But more than that, there's just simply a lot of unease between these two sides. But this is certainly a sport that needs to come to a deal, that needs to come to a compromise, that they can't go through another round of labor war, particularly with the collective bargaining agreement expiring at the end of the year. Let's hope cooler heads prevail, a deal is done, they can play ball and play ball safely before too long.
I know Joe's looking forward to it. All right, so today is the start of Black History Month, and all month, we're going to be asking our guests to really talk about a Black American who they want to showcase, who impacted their lives or history. So, Reverend Al, we'll start with you. Who are you looking at this morning?
Shirley Chisholm. Shirley Chisholm was the first Black woman elected to Congress in 1968. She ran for president in 1972. And you must remember that she ran at a time that she had to not only fight racism, but misogyny, sexism in her own community. I was honored as a teenager to work on her campaign. I got to know her well. She was an educator by profession. She made us city rect and speak well. And she taught us that we could be whatever we dreamed of being as she tried to break down walls. You must remember, as we look now at a black woman as vice president of the United States, that it started with an audacious woman from Brooklyn, New York, named Shirley Chisholm, who never stopped breaking down walls, whether they were erected against her race or against her gender. Shirley Chisholm made a path that many have followed and many are walking down.
Thank you, Rev. Coming up, our next guest questions if President Biden is serious about bipartisan unity. But is COVID relief the issue he should compromise on? Steve Rattner puts the president's proposal side by side with the GOP counteroffer to compare. Morning Joe is coming right back.
The International Rescue Committee works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Lebanon, displaced families are experiencing rough winter weather on top of war, hunger, and displacement. All of this has driven up food prices, destroyed infrastructure, and driven millions from their homes. Donations help the IRC provide families with resources like food, shelter, fuel, medicine, blankets, and cash assistance. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild.
It is 41 past the hour, a live look at Capitol Hill on this Monday morning. It's February 1st, everybody. Back now to the negotiations with the latest COVID relief bill. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, who has pushed back at parts of President Biden's COVID relief plan, says he doesn't appreciate the administration's approach to winning his support. This comes after Vice President Kamala Harris went straight to Manchin's constituents last week, telling a West Virginia news station about the need for leaders to, quote, step up.
The president and I feel very strongly that these are the moments when we are facing a crisis of unbelievable proportion, that the American people deserve their leaders to step up and stand up for them.
I saw it. I couldn't believe it. No one called me. We're going to try to find a bipartisan pathway for it. I think we need to, but we need to work together. That's not a way of working together, what was done.
Ooh. Joining us now, columnist for the National Journal, Josh Krasher, former Treasury official and Morning Joe economic analyst, Steve Rattner, and professor at London's University College, Mariana Mazzucato. She has a new book coming out called Mission Economy, a moonshot guide to changing capitalism. Wow, we'll get to the big picture in just a moment. But Josh, you write that Biden would be making a mistake not to find middle ground with the Republicans. This bill includes a lot of things in it, and Kamala Harris going straight to West Virginia local TV. I don't know. I feel like Manchin's someone you can pick up the phone and talk to.
Yeah, Mika. You know, it's a challenge when you have a 50-50 Senate. You have a president that made an inauguration speech that was pledged on unity and bipartisanship. And you have everyone in the Republican caucus, including Mitt Romney, against you. And you have the most moderate Democratic senator, Joe Manchin, speaking out against your proposal while you're trying to sell it in West Virginia. And, you know, look, I think there's reason to question whether Republicans truly want a bipartisan deal. But I think part of Joe Biden's promise as president is that he would work to try to cut these types of deals, to work to unify the country, to work to reach some degree of bipartisanship. And the fact that in the first couple of weeks of the administration, the instinct is to go fully partisan, to try to push as much stimulus, to try to get a $1.9 trillion deal without any compromise, without any discussions, is a challenging one. I think it's a good instinct that they're having a meeting with 10 Republican senators at the White House today to try to find some common ground. But I think you got to make the effort. That was part of the political promise that Biden made. And a lot of folks in the middle are watching and trying to see if there can be any room for bipartisanship in Washington.
So would it help if it were a standalone bill, Josh? I mean, like a $15 minimum wage. I'm all for that. But does it have to be in this bill? Can't that be addressed with later and soon?
Yeah, I mean, the White House has said this is a crisis. This is an emergency that they have to deal with right away. So there is a plan you could come up with where, as you note, Mika, you could spend money to help the vaccine distribution. You could put the money for schools and have that dealt with right away, and then deal with the stimulus checks and deal with the minimum wage separately. You could even use reconciliation. You could try to get a party line vote on those issues. But if it is such a crisis, if we need the money as soon as possible, there are obvious areas of bipartisan agreement. And it's one that they should, you know, it's easy to see how they could work together if it is such an emergency to get that money to the people.
I mean, to an extent, Steve Rattner, I guess you could argue that the minimum wage is part of the issue at this point because people are suffering so much. So it's not that black and white about trying to make this a standalone bill. The New York Times quoted several economists who said this $1.9 trillion price tag was actually higher than the actual economic hole that the economy is in caused by the crisis. Should Biden and Republicans work toward the actual number of lost output to try and rectify this situation? Or what's your best estimate as to how to address this?
Well, there are a couple of questions, of course. The question you've just asked is, what's the right number to solve this problem? I think the question that everybody's grappling with today is, how do you bring the Republicans and the Democrats together? Biden is negotiating on multi fronts. He's negotiating, will be today, and will be going forward, I believe, in good faith with the Republicans. He's going to be negotiating, in a sense, with Joe Manchin, and he's also and the other moderate Democrats, and he's going to be negotiating with the liberal party, the progressive part of the Democratic Party, which is putting enormous pressure on him to go big. They think we've had a problem for a while that needs to be addressed. You can see a chart on the screen which illustrates the problem of negotiating with the Republicans. You have 10 Republicans who've proposed a $600 billion package. That's the small circle on the left. And then you have Biden, who's proposed a $1.9 trillion package, which is the large circle on the right. They overlap. We do not know all the details of the Republican proposal yet. I think we'll know them today. The one place of overlap is on vaccines and pandemic containment. Everyone agrees on that, $160 billion. But after that, there are enormous differences. The Republicans believe, and I think there's some merit to this, that the stimulus checks should be more targeted to the people who really need them. During the last negotiation in December, one piece that fell out, which was of critical importance to the Democrats, was the money, the $350 billion for state and local governments. We'll see if the Republicans propose any of that back. But for the Democrats, I think that is pretty close to a non-negotiable demand. So look, I'm in the pessimistic camp, unfortunately. I would love to see us reach an agreement, us, the Democrats, with the Republicans on this. But let's just do a quick bit of history. In 2009, President Obama came in, different kind of crisis, but a big crisis, went to the Hill, got exactly zero votes in the House of Representatives after trying to negotiate with John Boehner, went to the Senate, eventually pried off three Republican votes, which he needed under the rules they were using at the time to pass the bill. It was Susan Collins, Olympia Snowe, and Arlen Specter, very moderate Republicans. Not sure he can do replace those with any others. And so I just see the gap as being enormous between $600 billion and $1.9 trillion. Both sides, certainly, I assume, will be prepared to compromise somewhat. The Republicans would have to keep 10 members of their caucus on board for whatever they added to the $600 billion. President Biden would have to keep his progressive wing on board as he went down from $1.9 trillion. And I wish I could be positive, but I think it's a very tough situation to believe we're going to have a bipartisan compromise.
Casey Hunt, jump in.
So, Josh, Steve brings up 2009, and there is clearly a lot of lessons that are being learned from the experience, both with that stimulus package and then, of course, the experience with trying to pass the Affordable Care Act. And Democrats really do need to make a choice. Do they want to spend the time trying to get Republicans on board only to potentially see no one go along with them? Or do they want to use this strategy that, frankly, Republicans have employed without looking back? They have done everything that they've done in the last 4 years that they did under Trump was done under these rules, because these were the rules that Mitch McConnell could use to pass things with 51 votes. And obviously, I mean, he failed on the healthcare front, too. But Is this the only chance Biden is going to have to build, President Biden's going to have to build a bipartisan consensus? And does the call that he makes in this moment determine the next 2 years, or will there be another shot?
So Casey, I think this is an important first shot. And the big difference between Obama in 2009 and Biden right now is that Obama had 59 Democratic senators, and Biden has a narrow 51 seat with Kamala Harris majority. So, you know, Biden really does need to build back better politically. He doesn't even have some of the more moderate Democrats like Joe Manchin in his corner. And he really needs the political capital right now. He needs a big win. If he could get some Republicans to break off from their party, it would be a big political win, a big political signal. And even if they did, even if you couldn't get 10 Republicans, which I acknowledge is a pretty tough challenge in our divided Washington, if you make the effort and you prove that Republicans really aren't willing to make the deals and the compromises necessary, it's also a political win. You show that you made the effort, Republicans weren't willing to deal, and you get some political capital from that too. But the notion that you just push everything through in a progressive, you know, the most progressive legislation possible on a party line vote without even, and it's good that they're having this meeting this afternoon, that they're trying to reach out, but it looked initially like this was going to be a partisan package and one that they didn't even want to have to talk to Republicans about.
Jonathan Lemire.
Mariana, I want to pose a different question to you. The correct question is, why not go big, right? Your book is about changing the very fundamentals, the foundation of the economy. And we certainly know that these numbers, the margins are small, the Democrats 50-50 in the Senate. Joe Biden is playing with somewhat of a limited hand, but he is in power. Democrats do control both branches of Congress. There is the ability in reconciliation to pass something along a party lines vote. Give us the argument. Should this be the moment where Joe Biden and the Democrats do go big, to use this moment to try to really change the very nature of the American economy?
Well, I think the answer is absolutely yes. And, you know, Janet Yellen's point earlier last week that without further action now and proper big action now, we risk a much more, she called it, a long-term scarring of the economy. That's going to be bad for business. That's going to be bad for Americans. So really thinking through the details. This isn't just about money. And I've been struck just listening to the program now that, you know, we need to talk about the structures also that Biden's putting back into place. One of the first things he did was to say that he had to open up again the U.S. Office of Science and Technology. That's going to help make America great again. We've just had 4 years of mercantilistic policy, all focused on walls, on, you know, trade agreements, on, you know, kind of beating the enemy abroad. This is really about rethinking America's place in the global economy, getting a stimulus package that's proper, not one third of that, which is what the 10 Republicans are going after that, but how you structure that recovery package in such a way that really fosters long-term growth and productivity and innovation, and long-term growth that actually helps solve the biggest problems that the U.S. has around health, around inequality, around climate is critical. And the whole climate debate, we need to remember this isn't a trade-off. You know, either you solve the vaccine problem or we go after pollution. If we look internationally, and I guess that's my role here on the panel because I'm sitting in London, it's so interesting to see how some countries have put conditionalities, for example, on the bailout to companies, whether it's Air France and Renault in France, where they had to lower their carbon emissions in order to access the recovery package. You know, Davos last week, all they talked about, the big business leaders, was stakeholder capitalism. This is a moment to stop talking about left and right, Democrats and Republicans, and to build back better for real business, government, and, you know, trade unions talking about how to structure the recovery.
So, Steve Rattner, real quick, just trying to play both sides here, the lib and me. Isn't the $15 an hour minimum wage potentially a part of COVID relief, or could it be argued that it would be? Are there other things that perhaps are less related that could be taken out of the bill?
Yes, you could argue that the $15 minimum wage is part of COVID relief, but it's a fairly blunt tool. Look, I'm all in favor of the $15 minimum wage, don't get me wrong. Yeah. But in terms of COVID relief, it's a fairly blunt tool because not everybody in that state of the income ladder is affected. Things like extending unemployment insurance and making the payments more general is more targeted relief. What the Biden administration is trying to do in this bill is a bit of both, COVID relief, but also a number of provisions, things on child care, tax credits, and things like that, that are are designed to help people at the bottom in a more general way as the beginning of the Build Back Better initiative that he's pushing forward.
Got it. All right. Josh Krasauer, Steve Rattner, Mariana Mazzucato, thank you all very much for being on for this important conversation. And still ahead, Dr. Zeke Emanuel, who advised the Biden transition, will be our guest as the South African COVID strain is detected in another U.S. state. Plus, the New York Times' Michael Schmidt with more from his wide-ranging new piece with his colleagues on Donald Trump's 77-day campaign to subvert the election. Morning Joe is coming right back.
Radio Andy.
Hey, it's Andy Cohen. Join me on Andy Cohen Live, where it's just you, me, and some of the world's biggest celebrities.
Paris Hilton.
Chelsea Handler.
Seth Rogen.
I love you, Miley. Thank you so much.
You can listen to Andy Cohen Live at home or anywhere you are. No car required. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.